This is episode number 762 of the Secret Identity Podcast. Today in What's New, we're going to talk about the passing of Richard Hatch, an announcement from Warrant Magazine, Archie Comics, Batman, and Spider-Woman. Our comics this week will be Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number 4, Titans number 8, Dead Inside number 2, and Justice League America Rebirth number 1. And our BooTube this week will feature Riverdale, Powerless, Legion, The Flash, and more.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
God clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring for a Secret Identity morning edition.
It is. This is a special edition. I don't know if we've ever recorded on a Friday morning.
I don't know that we've recorded on a Friday morning. I know that we've recorded like on a Saturday morning. Yep. I know we've done a couple morning episodes, but usually we are the afternoon crew.
Yes, the afternoon. We're not morning. Yeah. We're not morning. We're afternoon drive.
Yeah, we're the afternoon drive crew.
So yeah, I had to bring my wife and daughter to Logan Airport yesterday in Boston.
Yep.
To bring them to the plane to send them to Europe for 2.5 weeks, and was a little leery of the ride home because if you don't know Boston, get a bunch of matchbox cars, shake them up, dump them on the floor, kick them. That's usually the traffic patterns of Boston, and was not quite sure when I was going to get home. Made it home in pretty good time though.
Yeah, when all of the ramps are open, the way into and out of Logan in Boston is probably the easiest drive that you can do in Boston.
They were open.
Because it's just you come in, you loop around, you come back, and you're out.
See the sign that says Mass Pike West?
Yep.
You take it, you go.
If you have to do anything else in Boston, nightmare time.
You're going to end up in Cambridge like I do every time.
And basically, if you don't clear the outskirts of Boston by 4 o'clock, forget about it.
Yep, you're dead.
Then you're hitting traffic there. You're hitting traffic in Framingham, in Worcester. But the great news is by the time you get back to Springfield, it's probably midnight, so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah.
But everywhere else, you hit traffic.
I pretty much was worried that my family would get to Berlin before I would get to Springfield.
Sure. Yes. But here you are.
Here we
it
are.
It only took you 24 hours. You're back.
Yep.
Just got in a few minutes ago. And we are kicking off the latest episode of Secret Identity. So unfortunately, we have to start, as we often do, with a passing of not only a celebrity, but yet another person that we actually knew.
Yeah.
And that is Richard Hatch.
71 years old, and I believe it was cancer.
I believe you are correct, yes.
And the thing with Richard is he was somebody that when you got to know him, you instantly just fell right in because he was somebody that was so passionate about Battlestar Galactica, excited about any projects. And I remember he was very against the relaunch when it was coming.
Right.
And he had his own project that he was trying to push, which was
more like a continuation.
20 years after the War of the Gods episode in the original Galactica series.
Right.
Wrote 2 or 3 novels, which were great books, and always waved the flag. And I remember him not being very happy about the whole thing, but him saying, I'm not going to get in its way. I'm not going to cause a problem. I'm not going to tell Galactica fans not to watch it. But he said he was going to distance himself. And then I remember the big controversy when he came in as Tom Zarek, because it was the thought you didn't like it, dude. And I remember him saying something about, you know, Galactica's a vision and these guys caught the vision. They know exactly what they're doing and, it was interesting because at first we all thought he was going to be that, here's just the token character, give him his time and he'll go away. And Tom Zarek ended up being a main character.
He was a central character in that series.
The last 2 or 3 seasons.
Sure. Yeah.
Political wrangling that was going on in the Galactica. But just a great guy. Never, ever, ever heard anything negative about him. And at a show, when we would see him at shows all the time, there was always a crowd around his table because he just loved to talk.
Yeah, he was a very nice guy. I remember meeting him at United FanCon, which again, we just talked about John Wetton at United FanCon. That show, which is no longer around, we have some great memories of.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was where I met Peter David.
Yep.
For the first time. And he signed my Spidey 2099 poster. I mean, that was where we met Sylvester McCoy.
Yep. We hung out with Matthew Lewis.
From Harry Potter.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, it just a lot of great memories. Because it was such a small show,
yeah.
You ended up rubbing elbows with people. And that was a really fun time. We had a good time at that show. He will be missed, obviously.
Yeah. And I remember at that show, too, we kind of forget about the fact that there was a kind of a snowstorm that came in early. So people were very late getting in. And a lot of the celebrities, like with Matthew Lewis, he just was wandering around. I was with the comic book store I was at, and we had a room in the back where all the comic book people was. And
it was a room that is not much bigger than the room that we are in right now, which is essentially smaller than like a master bedroom.
And Matthew Lewis hung out with us for a ton of time. And I remember his parents kept coming in going, "Is he all right?" And we're like, "Oh my gosh, yeah."
I remember explaining D&D miniatures to Sylvester McCoy.
Yes.
I was actually sitting with Doctor Who teaching him how to play D&D minis.
Yep.
So like there's some great – I remember buying a bootleg DVD set of The Tick. Television
and
the
Sean
cartoon.
Wong was there,
and Sean Wong was there, who obviously had drawn The Tick before and did a awesome cover.
Yeah,
well, I basically turned over the cover on it, and he sketched an entire cover for my DVD set. Really awesome. But yeah, I mean, back to Richard Hatch, like when he came on to the new Battlestar Galactica show, he became a fixture of that show,
yep.
And it's kind of amazing that in two incarnations of it, he was a central character.
Mm-hmm.
And played them both, you know, wonderfully.
Yeah.
Like, because people who knew him from the original series, now when you think of him as a bad guy or at least a controversial guy,
yes,
in the new series, that was a role that you didn't know if people were going to warm up to or not. But lo and behold, by the time that series was over, he was one of the more beloved characters of that new incarnation.
Yeah. And you took Richard Hatch in the original as the, like you were just saying, he was all light. He was a warrior. He was leading his people. And then in the next one, he was a little murky because
he was gray,
ties.
You know. Yeah,
he was a terrorist to some, a freedom fighter to others, which kind of struck a chord with a lot of people. I remember reading things about, you know, like the Galactica fans in Ireland completely understanding Tom Zarek because of, you know, the IRA stuff going on. That, you know, some look at him as terrorists, some look at. So it was a really interesting thing, and like you said, he became a character that, after a while, you just were like, oh, there, a great scene coming up. And he was a great actor, too.
I feel like that has been long enough that we are away from that show now where I might want to give it another watch. Like, when it was over, I was so ready for it to be over. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But I think now I want to go back and give it another, especially those first few seasons.
First two seasons were fantastic.
The first few seasons were great. And then it got... I think it kind of lost its way, but overall, I mean, that's a show that you're happy exists, you know?
Yes.
You have an announcement. I'm looking at the magazine that you have in front of you, Creeps, and that was one that we've talked about on the show before, but the parent company had an announcement this week, correct?
Yeah, so Warrant Publishing is the company that puts out a magazine called The Creeps. Now, Warrant Publishing is a lot like Warren Publishing. Now, Warren put out the great black and white magazines in the 70s and 80s, Creepy, Eerie, The Rook. Vampirella made her debut in that line as well. And The Creeps is really playing along with the whole creepy, eerie thing, that six, seven black and white, six or seven stories, black and white, five, six pages in, where you get the story and you get some crazy twist and you get stuff that you really, if you're our age, really miss. And Warrant has put out, I believe they're on issue number 10, and they have announced that The Creeps will no longer just be available at booksellers like Barnes & Noble, but they will be in Previews Guide. So it's a great magazine. If you haven't been able to find it, when you go to the comic store, flip through Previews, you can go into Warrant Publishing. And the thing is, a $5.99 book, which for what you're getting is not bad at all.
Right.
Because if you think about it too, I think Creepy and Eerie were probably $3, $4 at the time.
Right.
But they are not only a nostalgia filled romp of fun, but it is definitely contemporary enough where a 20-year-old comic fan can pick it up and really get something out of it.
I'm excited about that because you have gotten me excited about that magazine because you've been picking it up. You get this at Barnes & Noble,
right? Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. But you'll be able to get it at our local comic shop in the near future. Let's talk about Archie for a second. And we're going to talk about Archie a lot over the coming weeks and months because we are fans of Riverdale. We'll talk about Riverdale in our boob tube. But this past week, comes an article from The Hollywood Reporter, Matthew. Everything's coming up Archie.
Ooh.
In the wake of the launch of Riverdale on the CW, Archie Comics has signed an exclusive deal with Warner Brothers Television to develop more of the publisher's properties for television and original content. As Archie CEO John Goldwater tells The Hollywood Reporter, the deal extends beyond the traditional Riverdale crew of Archie, Betty, and Veronica, as seen in the current CW series. It could include lesser-known properties, including America's Queen of Pinups and Fashions, Katie Keene, as well as superheroes of the company's Dark Circle imprint.
Oh, wow.
Archie is unique in that we have a huge library of characters that are not only recognizable, but they're successful and entertaining, Goldwater says. Riverdale creator Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa told reporters last month that he was interested in creating a whole Archie world. The series, with its dark tone and sexy new murder mystery plot, has been a critical hit. The deal is similar to Warner Brothers TV's pact with DC Comics, which has seen it put a whole stable of series on the air, including Arrow, The Flash, Legends, and Supergirl, as well as Fox's Gotham and NBC's Powerless. Riverdale's success and the TV pact marks the latest stage in Goldwater's push to modernize Archie as a company, which started with the 2010 introduction of Kevin Keller, the first openly gay character in the publisher's long history, and continued with the launch of the series that featured an adult Archie struggling with post-life marriage, which was, what was that one called?
That was The Life of Archie.
The Life of Archie. Coinciding with the news of the Warner Brothers deal, Archie revealed that Mark Waid, the writer of flagship comic book series Archie, will be expanding his relationship with the company later this year by signing up to co-write a number of series, as well as mentoring upcoming writers, with the overall aim of growing the current stable of talent at the company.
Yeah, I'm in.
I mean,
we love Mark Waid.
These all sound like good moves to me. This opportunity is exciting to me for a number of reasons, Waid says about the new deal, which will be effective in May when he takes over writing the Jughead series with new co-writer Ian Flynn. First, the chance to expand my role as a writer at Archie is terrific, as we all share the same storytelling goals. Second, it allows me to exercise my editorial muscles, which, surprise, is why I got into comics in the first place. But most of all, the opportunity to help build a more diverse staff of writers, younger, eager to learn, and eager to teach me. I like all of that.
I do, too.
Because I was just talking to somebody about, I think I was talking to Daryl. We were talking about the fact that Marvel, well, this is a spoiler for another story we're going to talk about, is getting ready to do another reboot, rebirth sort of thing. And we talked about how it seems to be the same stable of writers that keeps getting recycled. It's like the NFL coaching carousel.
Yes.
Like when you see these major book announcements from DC and from Marvel, it is very hard for new writers to crack into that because the established writers keep taking all those sort of top
yes.
gigs. You know what I mean? So seeing the commitment of Archie to bring in new talent and diverse talent and to have someone like Mark Waid sort of mentoring that new talent, that all sounds awesome to me. And we've also talked about on many an occasion the approach that Mark Waid takes to characters.
Yes.
You and I both had a chance to interview him at the, was it White?
White.
We were in White Plains.
White Plains.
New York Comic Fest.
New York Comic Fest.
I believe it was. We got a chance to talk to him about different things, but both of us, you know, hit on the fact that that's something that rings true in whatever character he's writing. At the time, it was Daredevil, you know, when we talked about Thrillbent, his comic stuff. So I'm psyched about him having a huge role there. The article goes on to talk more about the Riverdale show and stuff like that. But the gist of it was that they just signed a new deal. They're going to have new properties that are going to be coming not only to TV, but probably in other areas as well. You and I have joked about video games in the past and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I would also like to see novels. I think there's a lot of room for there to be expanded stories told in the Archie universe. When I watch Riverdale now, this incarnation of Archie to me on TV feels like the precursor to Afterlife with Archie.
Oh, I do.
Like, I feel like this is, you could do this series for 5 years and then do like two or three seasons of Afterlife with Archie after that and just follow straight. Because again, it's Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa. He wrote Afterlife with Archie.
Yep.
So what we're seeing from Cheryl and Jason Blossom, that is 100% the Afterlife with Archie incarnation of the Blossoms that we're seeing in this show in Riverdale. So he's pulling from this darker version of Riverdale that he created for Afterlife with Archie for the TV show. And to me, that you could just plant the seeds. I mean, they could basically create the next Walking Dead coming out of the Archie universe if they were bold enough to make that move at some point.
Yeah. And it's also really interesting as I've been watching, we're four episodes in. I didn't watch last night's, so you didn't either. And we came in like the first episode of Archie drops you probably like way beyond the middle of what you could be telling for stories. I mean, I want to know why Archie's parents split up. I want to know what happened with Betty's sister and with Jason. I want to know all these things that have happened. And I think the thing with Roberto with his writing and what he has done is he's created something where you can easily go back 20, 30 years in the Riverdale story and just tell some amazing stuff. I want to know what the connection is. I want to know who Veronica's mother dated while she was living in there, because she obviously dated Archie's dad. So lots of stories that
keep
can be
in mind
told.
Too, that the CW has the CW Seed, which is where we've seen the animated series like Vixen and stuff like yep. that on. They are not afraid to do animated stuff as well. It would not shock me if there was some traditional Archie style cartoons
yeah.
that came out of this. You could have a Josie and the Pussycat series. You could have a, there's so many things that you could do with this stuff. So I'm excited to see what they do with that. It is super exciting to me. And I was talking to my son the other day about how when you look at what has happened at Archie over the past several years, that whole trajectory we've kind of watched happen.
Absolutely.
From like front row
too.
Seats.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you go back to the early days of Secret Identity, when we met Mike Pellerito at a kids Comic Con.
Yep.
And we, and Archie was so firmly established in sort of the younger readers area. And then they started to, and then they had all the video game properties, which Mike started on. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Sonic, right?
He was the assistant editor
right.
on Sonic
and so,
the Hedgehog.
You know, seeing him there and then coming to New York Comic Con every year and seeing the Archie booth get bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it's become one of the centerpieces of
yep.
the New York Comic Con floor. And then to see Afterlife with Archie become such a huge critical and fan hit. You know, if they hadn't been plagued by the lateness of the book,
yep.
that series would be still at the top of everybody's mind. The Sabrina series, absolutely fantastic. Like, so the moves that they've been making have been very interesting, and it seems like have paid off for the company to this point. And they're still putting out the double digests, and they're still putting out the traditional books so that people who just want that incarnation of Archie,
you get it.
You can still get that. And it's kind of amazing to see that whole thing evolve. So that's your Archie news. Let's talk about Batman, because the last time that we recorded, we were talking about the fact that Affleck was no longer going to direct the Batman movie. So that was in late January that he talked about how he wasn't going to do that. Variety reports that a new director has stepped up, Matt Reeves, who is best known for directing Cloverfield, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and the upcoming War for the Planet of the Apes. He is the guy who's going to be directing the new
yep.
Batman movie, the standalone Batman movie. Now, since I wrote this story down to talk about it, I have also heard a lot of rumors that Affleck no longer wants to play Batman either. And so now they're looking for another actor who could potentially replace him. And I don't believe that's been confirmed that he's not going to play Batman. And in fact, the contract that he has to play Batman might be airtight in that there is no getting out of him
yep.
playing Batman. But it seems like his interest in the DC cinematic universe has lessened since whatever the movie that just came out of his, Live by Night or something
yeah,
like that.
The mobster
which he directed
piece.
Or something
he,
too.
He like, directed it. He adapted it, starred in
that
it.
That was a super bomb.
Yep.
And it sounds like that was one of the things that made DC skittish about letting him have creative control over everything that's happening with Batman, because that was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's so funny. Daryl and I were talking about this too. You know, like right now, when you look at DC's comic front, I don't know what the numbers say, but I can tell you in terms of anecdotally in who I talk to at the comic shop and in conversations that we have with people, it feels like DC is putting out better comics than Marvel right now.
Agreed.
When you talk about the big two.
Sales-wise, they're
yes,
way up there too.
It feels like Rebirth has been a success in that it is giving us both new heroes that are coming in, but also a return to the heroes that people really felt like they had a connection with and a connection to the legacies of those
yep.
heroes. So that feels like it's going in the right direction, whether or not the sales are actually reflecting that. And it feels like Marvel is struggling a little bit to really figure out what their identity is right now. Civil War II was not a critical success. I'm not sure how it did financially, but it definitely was not something that people were very excited about. And now you have the Cap event coming up, which people have already made up their minds around, whether they're in for the Hydra Cap or they're out for the Hydra Cap, you know, is going to determine what their mileage is on that. So there's rumors now, and this was a story I was going to save for the next episode, but I will read it now because it talked about it talked about a possible rebirth for Marvel. Or maybe I didn't pull that story. But the rumor is, and it sounds like that rumor has pretty much been confirmed at this point, is that Marvel is going to do sort of a rebirth type of thing. They're going to reboot or return to the roots of some of their main characters. And we've already seen one book be announced, Spectacular Spider-Man, I think, was just announced. And that is going to be sort of a return to classic Spidey that is coming up pretty soon. I want to say Chip Zdarsky is going to be writing that one. And Peter David's going to be doing a Scarlet Spider series, by the way, too, on top of that. But so Marvel seems like they're sort of chasing DC a little bit in the ideas department. And it's going to be interesting to see how that pays off for them, because as we talked about, people are getting really tired of these annual reboots that are sort of forgetting about the legacy of the previous characters and stuff like that. So, but DC's problem is that they can't get their head out of their butt when it comes to the movies.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at the television universe, we love that.
Yep.
Most of the people we talk to really enjoy the television universe.
Non-comic book fans.
Seems like that's going well for them.
Yep.
Comic book front. DC's rebirth, a success. Feels like the comic book line is in a good position right now. You got guys like Tom King who are writing Batman and just nailing it. You've got Superman, which is great right now. You've got Superwoman, which is a great book right now. Green Arrow, I'm reading. A lot of those titles, I'm still Deathstroke, I'm reading. So where I worry about DC is in two places. Number one, the movie universe. They're all over the place with that. They got to get it together when it comes to the vision that they have for that cinematic universe and the plan, because it feels like it's all over the place. When you see the trailer for Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and it looks like it could be better than Guardians of the Galaxy 1, that spells trouble for DC on the cinematic front. Marvel's got that on lock. Marvel's not so great in the television arena. DC's got the television arena. But DC's got to get their stuff together around the movies, because that seems to me to be the only place right now that is holding them back from being definitively on top.
Yes.
If they were able to align that and get everybody feeling good about that DC cinematic universe, then they kind of are playing to all fields at that point.
Yeah, they've got a good card hand, but still the one card that they need is the movies, and that is what Marvel runs. And right now, you know, DC has 3/4 of the pie, but that biggest, most important part is the movie part. And if they don't have that, everything else is kind of still keeping them in the second tier.
The other place that DC is going to screw themselves is with the move to $3.99. That's a stupid move.
I've already been panicky about that too.
I understand why they're doing it, because they need to make up that dollar share. But at the same time, that's a dumb move. Whether or not it's more pages or whether or not it's a better value or you're only buying the book once a month, none of that matters. The reality of the financial situation doesn't matter. All that matters is that when someone walks into the store, the cover price on the book is $3.99 and not $2.99. Yep. It's the same thing with Marvel's $4.99 one issues, or, you know, $4.99 event issues, or $5.99 event issues. It doesn't matter why.
Yep.
It could be better cover. It could be more pages. It could be, you know, extra digital code. It doesn't matter.
You just see the cover.
You see the cover price. $3.99 is a bad move for DC. $2.99 is a great move for DC. Mm-hmm. I'd rather see more $2.99 books than seeing any of their books go to $3.99, because there will be books that I am absolutely dropping.
Same with me.
That hit $3.99.
Yep.
I'm just not going to buy them anymore. And so that to me could be a big misstep, because I feel like everything else that they're doing on the comic front feels right now.
Yep.
So anyways, so the Batman thing, I'm interested to see how that works out, because if that's another thing, that it's the perception of the situation, right? The perception that you want of the Batman movie is that Ben Affleck is 100% invested in being the Batman of the DC universe. Whether these stories are even true or not, whether he's looking to back out of the role or not, none of that matters. You want the perception to be that he is 100% in, that this is all going very well, that everything is going according to plan, you know, in terms of the production. They have their new director in place and we are full steam ahead. You want all that stuff to appear on the outside to be running very, very smoothly. And that is not the appearance mm-hmm. that we're getting right now. And so that just gives people an opening to question what the quality of the movie is going to be. It was the same thing with Suicide Squad, right? When you hear about all the reshoots and the new direction and all that kind of stuff.
And you saw it when you watched it.
But I think you saw it when you – well, some of it was very obvious, yep. right? But you also go into that movie knowing that in the back of your mind.
Yes.
As opposed to, had we known none of that, had there never been a peep about any problems with Suicide Squad, it all went exactly the way it was according to plan. You don't have that in the back of your nope. head when you go in to watch the movie. Maybe some of that stuff doesn't register with you. Maybe you walk out of it with a better perception yep. of the movie. Now, the movie made a ton of money. There's no arguing that. But again, for the long-term health of the DC Cinematic Universe, you want the perception to be that they are running on all cylinders. Marvel, that is the perception of them, even though that's probably not true. Even though Marvel has obviously had stuff go on behind the scenes, yep. even though some of those movies aren't as good as some of the other movies, they're able to maintain this general overall perception of, man, Marvel's killing it with yeah. their cinematic universe, right? So that's where DC has their biggest problem. It's an image problem.
Yeah. Like with Marvel, they can turn around and say, you know what? We are so good at what we're doing. And we saw this and talked about this maybe 3 years ago. When you started looking at what was going to be released in the next couple of years, you see Ant-Man and you're like thinking, all right, now you're being a little too arrogant with how good
right, that's the one that's going to stumble.
And then you're like, oh, well, that movie was really good.
Right. I mean, like, was it as good as, you know, Captain America? No, but it wasn't a huge misstep for
no,
them.
Not at all.
Doctor Strange was another one. You know, I like Doctor Strange, but I
didn't even see it.
You didn't even see it.
I didn't even see it.
But I felt like going into that this is the one where they're going to stumble. It wasn't. It was yeah. it was a good Marvel movie. You know, and so they have a good Marvel movie every year and then a great Marvel movie every yep. year. It's either good or great. Like that's the general perception of those. That's not even just my perception of those. So that's where I kind of feel like DC just needs to get that together.
Yeah.
Because they're with the content they're putting out from a comic standpoint and with the content they're putting out from a TV standpoint, I really like what DC's doing. And traditionally, you could probably put me as more of a Marvel guy when it comes to the big two. Most of my books are DC now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting the Spider Family, Miss Marvel, and I don't know what else I'm getting from the Marvel Universe right now. None of the Avengers books, none of the Captain America books.
Yep.
You know, I just picked up Wasp, which we're going to talk about, I think, in the next episode. But most of my stuff is DC now. And a lot of the reason for that is because of a combination of the $2.99 price point, which means I will try anything that comes out if I haven't checked it out before, and give books a longer leash
yep.
because I'm giving them more issues to impress me now, and the fact that most of the books are impressing me when I read them.
Yes.
So last thing I want to mention in the news is that I was very disturbed this week to see a headline on Bleeding Cool that said Spider-Woman stealth canceled in March.
Huh.
It says, Marvel listed the following for March 2017. Spider-Woman number 17. Dennis Hopeless, Veronica Fish, Javier Rodriguez doing the cover. Spider-Woman's tangled web, tangle with Tiger Shark, Blizzard, and a whole host of supervillains in her time, but nothing has prepared her to take on a goblin. Jessica's about to put it all on the line like she never has before. The problem is, there's no more issues solicited after that.
Oh, boy.
So, this is not something that Marvel has announced. They also say on Bleeding Cool, the Amazon collection of the book only goes up to issue 17. There's no listing for number 18. So it would appear that perhaps Spider-Woman is canceled, which I know not everybody loves that book. For me, one of the best Marvel yeah. books, actually probably the best Marvel book that I'm reading right now. And I'm going to be really, really upset if that book just got canceled. I just raved about that in the yep. last episode that
yes,
we recorded.
Did.
And then it shows up that it might get canceled.
Let's just start hating everything. Keep these books around.
I know. It's a huge bummer, man. That's too bad. So there you go. That is your news for this week. Before we get into comics, I will briefly just mention our wonderful sponsor, which is VikingOilsLLC.com. Viking Oils, of course, makes a variety of beard products, Matthew.
Yes.
Which I use on a daily basis.
And I'm back using the beard balm every day now.
I noticed that you're letting some grow in a little bit, and yes. I like to see that. It's good to have you back in the beard family.
Yes, it's good to be back.
You can justify to yourself that we're moving towards the playoffs in the NHL, so you're getting your playoff beard ready to go.
Might as well start it now.
I don't have to grow one because the Canucks aren't going to sniff the playoffs this year, so that won't be a problem for me. But it is spring training in baseball.
Oh, pitchers and
a lot of the guys come in. A lot of the pitchers and catchers come in with their beards ready to go, you know, from the offseason. So I love the Viking oil stuff. I have used the beard oil consistently for a couple of years now and could not make it through the winter without it. So go check out VikingOilsLLC.com, or you can click on the button that's on the front page of our website and you can go check them out.
And I will get with Gary and see what we can get for a couple new products so we can try some stuff out.
Excellent.
And so, then in the next episode, Brian, we'll be talking about somebody new that's kind of not necessarily sponsoring, but part of the Secret Identity family.
Oh, I'm excited to hear about that. I'm also excited to talk about the first book that I want to review and discuss this week, which is Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number 4. Now, this is a series that is written by Jerry Conway. The art is by Ryan Stegman, who I really, really like. Colorist Sonia Obak and Jesus Abertov. Joe Caramagna is the letterer. I think we know that guy. Yep. And the editor is Darren Shan. Now, Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows, when the whole Spider-Verse thing was happening, this was an alternate universe where Peter and Mary Jane were married. They had a child named Annie May, and she had spider powers. And this was also the universe that the villain Regent appeared in. And he was the guy who had a suit that could siphon the powers from superheroes and supervillains. So there was a limited series that happened during Spider-Verse. Now they have spun out into their own book. I'm not sure how many issues it's planned to go or if it's just planned to be an ongoing moving forward. But 4 issues in, this book is filling for me the void that the Fantastic Four left when the family book of the Marvel Universe left. And I think you'll see why when we start talking about this story, because what this first arc has been about is a battle with the Mole Man. And so you have one of the Fantastic Four's classic villains.
The first.
That the Spider family is now facing off against. And so basically the premise or the setup for this is that Peter's daughter, Annie, has powers. Mary Jane also has powers now because when Regent was defeated, they used the technology from his suit to basically build a suit for Mary Jane where she could tap into Peter's powers when she wore her suit and also have a version of spider powers for herself. So the setup is that all 3 of them now can have spider powers together. You have Spidey, who is used to working alone and is having to deal with the idea that his daughter is now in control enough of her powers that she wants to go out and do good. And he's got to figure out how to do that while keeping her safe. And he's also got his wife, who is fearless and also able to tap into these powers now. And she doesn't necessarily want to live within his parameters of when she should or should not be using these powers. So you have basically Annie and MJ who have decided, we're going to use these powers and we're going to jump into the same situations that you jump into, whether you like it or not. And Peter's having a tough time adjusting to it because now instead of fighting by himself, he's got 2 people alongside of him that not only does he care about and want to keep safe, but also has to coordinate with. And what we've seen in a lot of this series so far up to the first 4 issues is that there's a lot of miscommunication and a lot of uncoordination happening that is making it more difficult for them to deal with a guy like the Mole Man. Mm-hmm. But what the Mole Man has done is he has salvaged some technology from Regent's facility that basically harnesses people's life energy and turns it into a powerful sort of laser beam. And he's going to use that technology to rule the surface world. So he's going to attack the surface world. And in this 4th issue, the Spider family is down underground trying to stop him from taking this technology to the surface. And so a lot of the things that I just mentioned are all sort of playing out through this issue as they're chasing Mole Man through the underground caverns and they're chasing his, what does he call them? The mole, whatever his underlings are.
The mollusks?
I forget what it is. He says it at one point. I'll find it. But they're sort of pursuing him through these tunnels in these places. And Peter and Mary Jane are bumping into each other because they're both web swinging in the same area. The 2 of them are arguing about what they should or shouldn't let, you know, Annie do. And in the meantime, she's sneaking off to stop the bad guy because mom and dad are arguing about what it is that she should and shouldn't be able to do. And you have Mole Man who is monologuing the entire time about how they're not going to stop them. And he's finally going to, you know, take care of Reed Richards. So even in this scenario, even in this alternate universe, he is talking about defeating, Molloids. That's what he calls them. Molloids. M-O-L-L-O-I-D-S. He's talking about how he's going to use this technology to defeat Reed. So as the Spider family finally manages to get on the same page and coordinate an attack against Mole Man, they actually pretty easily defeat him because he has sacrificed over half of his Molloids to power this weapon now. So he's depleted his own army, and then they come in and flank him and end up disabling the technology and sort of knocking him out. But what you're getting in this fourth issue is a lot of the banter back and forth of, you know, them trying to get on the same page and arguing about what they should and shouldn't be letting Annie do. Meanwhile, she's in there helping save the day. So by the time this first arc wraps up, you have them having defeated as a family their first major challenge in this new, you know, landscape after Regent is gone. You also have young Normie Osborn, the son of Liz Allen, who is also, he just bought the land where Regent technology was, and he is also scavenging some of that technology. And he also has seen Annie out there in her spider outfit, and he knows there's a girl his age who has some sort of powers, and he is looking into what that is all about. Other supporting characters that you have in this book, Betty Brant is sort of the main reporter for the Bugle. And so her and Jonah are in this issue as well. So you have a lot of familiar faces from the Marvel Universe in here, but the main dynamic is between Peter and Mary Jane and Annie. And so again, if you were one of those people who were so frustrated after one more day because Peter and Mary Jane weren't together anymore, this is your book. And it's being drawn beautifully by Ryan Stegman, and Jerry Conway, who knows a thing or two about spider characters, is doing a wonderful job with it. And it has a feel to me that is kind of uplifting and has that family vibe that, again, the Fantastic Four really captured for me. That interplay between Johnny and Ben and Reed and Sue, I miss that.
Yeah.
And having that in this Spider-Man book is kind of awesome. So if you're craving that family feel of the Fantastic Four, I think Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows is a book that you should be checking out. And there is going to be an issue 5 because it talks about the next story arc after that. So I know it's not just a 4-issue limited series. I don't know if this is a book that's going to continue on past that. Now, I would say that I could give you a code.
Let's see what happens.
I'm glad I brought this up. Listen to this, Matthew.
Oh, here we go.
Listen to this.
Oh, boy.
So, I'm sorry we're backpedaling a little bit, but in the news story, we just talked about how DC is raising the price of their books, right? Well, what they're doing is they're pulling a page out of what Marvel was doing, and they are offering a digital code for the $3.99 books that you buy. So, you'll be able to redeem a digital version of that. Marvel, my understanding, is backpedaling.
Oh, boy.
On their digital code distribution, and I think we're seeing the first thing of it. It says, bonus digital content. Redeem the code on this page for free digital copies of the first issues in Invincible Iron Man, Avengers, and Cloak and Dagger. Now, again, that's nice.
Yeah.
That they're giving you a couple of different issues of different titles. What they're not giving you anymore is the digital version of the issue that you're reading. So I'm going to give you a code
for something.
But as in the past, where I would tell you that you can get yourself a digital copy of this Spider-Man issue, it is not a digital copy of that. It's for other comics. But I'm going to hand it out anyways.
Wow.
But that's a real bummer. So if you go to marvel.com/redeem and you enter the code PY84MDHDR1W5, you will get Iron Man, Avengers, and a Cloak and Dagger issue, which again, nice handful of comics, but I feel like they're just pulling things out of the Marvel Unlimited library and throwing them out there as opposed to giving you a copy of this. Now, if they were doing that and knocking the price down of this particular comic to $2.99,
do it.
Then you've got me.
Yep.
I don't need a digital copy. So it's just weird. There's weird things going on with that. But don't let that take away from Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows. Fun book.
So when DC was not necessarily announcing the launch of Rebirth, there were a lot of things going on that were giving clues to something that was going to happen big. One of the big ones was Out of Titans Hunt. That was a miniseries that took all the Teen Titans characters and made them centerpiece of what ended up becoming Rebirth, especially Wally West, where Barry Allen always seemed to be the one in the middle of everything. In Rebirth, it was Wally West. Wally West was the whole catalyst for this whole thing. He was what was holding everything together. And as we are 8 issues into the Titan series, he's still feeling a little weird about everything that has happened.
Because he was basically forgotten.
He was married and had a wife. He was married with a wife and had 2 kids. And they're no longer – she's there. He's seeing her and talking with her. He still has feelings for her, but she has no clue. And I think right there, that is such a huge, huge story. But at the same time, Wally is out there being a superhero. He's helping his team, and he isn't moping. I mean, there might be – like in this one, there was – a couple pages of him reflecting and talking to Arsenal about how he feels and what's going on. But for the most part, it isn't, you know, all right, I'll go save that building, but why bother? Because nobody ever saved anything in my life, blah, blah. That stuff doesn't happen. So in Titans.
That's the kind of talk that leads to supervillainy, Matthew.
Yes. So in Titans number 7, it ended with the team deciding that they were going to get a building in Manhattan. And they were going to put Titans Tower, that has always been, I think, in San Francisco, in the middle of the bay there. It is now going to be in Manhattan. And the last issue had a ton of cool things in there. Like Bruce Wayne was going to be the benefactor. And they brought basically a real estate agent and some other people in to look at this property. And they're like, you have a jet? Well, this is a no-fly zone. Well, Bruce Wayne will take care of it. Bruce Wayne can't take care of it. It is a no-fly zone. This is the way life is. You're going to have a sub? Well, this boat can't come out of here because it's a harbor. And so all these things, all these real-life problems are starting to hit the Titans as they were building this base in Manhattan. Now, when I first heard the Titans were moving to Manhattan, and they kept talking about Manhattan and the everything would be like in a dream, watch for Manhattan. I was thinking it was going to be Dr. Manhattan because when we had the relaunch, he was shown at the very end of it. And there's still talk of him coming back in.
I was thinking that we don't have enough superheroes in New York.
Yes.
So it's good that they are moving to an area that is very depleted when it comes to superheroes.
In the DC universe, it is void of superheroes. So we start this part of the story off with you've got Mal, who used to be a superhero. And then you have, I can't think of her name, but she used to be the Bee. So these are like kind of the really lesser characters in the Teen Titan history. They came in the later run of the very first series, and they are there talking about the fact that Mal got rid of his powers, because he wants to be a regular person. He wants to be a father, a husband, and his wife is kind of wondering what's going on here and thinking, I don't know if I want to give up my powers. I enjoy this. So they're kind of talking about this, and they go to a place, and the place is called Meta Solutions. So it's really interesting that now in comics, they're referring – in the DC universe, they're referring to superheroes as metas like they do on the TV show. Like, and if you ever watch Flash, they very rarely mention superhero. And if they do, it's always in sort of a jokey matter like, oh, go be a superhero. But if they ever talk about anybody with powers, they're always metas. So here they're embracing the whole meta thing. And as they're there talking, Mal is kind of talking about the fact that when he fought Blockbuster and Blockbuster almost killed him, that was when he said, you know what? Not going to do the superhero thing. I got too much to live for. So as she's like, well, you know what? I'm going to go meet with these people and see what they have to say. So you meet this guy named Malcolm, or her name was Karen, Peter Simon. Now, Simon, I believe, isn't Simon, P-S-I-M-O-N, is the big brain guy who was in the Fearful Five, or not the Fearful Five, but the Teen Titan group that they fight.
Uh-huh.
He's sort of a brain guy. They introduce him to this group, and he is here, and he is able to get the powers out of people. Now you go to Titans Tower in New York City, as Donna is there and she's trying to piece together all of her memories of life before, of life, what's going on. She was adopted, so she has no idea about anything other than when she became an Amazon. And what I love about this is that they're really playing into the fact that Donna Troy, even when we had just the basic DC universe in the 80s, she had like 55 different origins, and it just kept getting changed around and changed all over the place. But before I go, let me continue, start with you have Dan Abnett, who is writing it. You've got Brett Booth who's the penciler and Norm Rapmund who is the inker. Andrea Dollhouse is the colorist. So as we go through this, and Dan Abnett is writing this book with the depth that he and Andy Lanning wrote your Annihilation stuff with, where you are just captivated by
that. Makes me want to read it.
This entire universe that they have created within a big T standing in the middle of New York City. And so you've got Arsenal and Donna, and they're talking about everything and things that are going on. And then it's Nightwing. I'm sorry, it wasn't Arsenal. It was Nightwing that walks into Wally's room, and he's just kind of sitting there looking at a picture of Linda. And then he's talking with her, and he's saying, you know, yeah, it looks like we're going to go out on a date. And Wally's like, so how's things going to go? And he goes, well, we're kind of just seeing each other right now. We're just getting together. We're talking because for me to tell her that I was her husband in a previous life, it's a little overwhelming for her. And you can understand that. So the two of them are talking about what's going on. And Wally's like, or Dick says to him, you've got the classic perfect do-over. If things work out, and he's like, and I know they will, you've got a chance to fix every wrong, every dumb thing you ever did when you were married. You know what you did. You get to fix this and do it right. So he's like, don't look at it as the negative. Look at it as you're getting a chance to start this fresh and right all over again. And then as you turn the page, you're starting to see more. You're having what's his name? So you have Aqualad, who is working with Lilith. Now, Lilith is – she's got mind power. She can read minds. So in a fist fight, she's kind of useless. So she is working with Aqualad. And as they are talking, he's like, all right, you got – he said, you got to hit me. She goes, I don't want to hit you. And he goes, look, you got to hit me because we need to teach you how to fight. So he puts his hands up for her to start sparring. And then he's like, oh, that's great. And then she freaking whacks him in the face. And he's like, okay, we got to work on that part of it. So now back to Meta Solutions. And you're finding out that the Simon guy has done what he wants to do to Mal, what he's already done to Mal and what he's done to her. And that is take powers away. And he has these suits that he can put on you, which will contain all the power. You can do all this stuff. And as she's in there getting a little confused, you got Mal who's sitting out in the waiting line waiting, and you've got Blockbuster who's wearing like this three-piece suit, walk up to the counter and start talking to the receptionist. Mal starts freaking out, remembering when he almost got killed by him, goes running out of the building, freaking out. And he's like, oh my God, what have I done? Because he starts panicking, thinking, I just brought her there. So as they realize something's wrong because all of a sudden there's a psychic blast. What's her name? I keep forgetting her name. But Lilith is like, look, Mal is in New York. He's the Herald. He was the Herald. Mal is in New York. There's something wrong. We need to get there. We need to get to where he is. So the Titans all show up. They find Mal and they're like, what's going on? What's happening? He says, look, we're at Meta Solutions. Karen is in there. I left her in there because Blockbuster showed up. Or Mammoth, not Blockbuster. Mammoth showed up and I freaked out. And the other Titans are like, what's going on? He's like, well, don't forget, Mammoth almost killed him. So he has every right to be freaky about it. So they go in, they start heading over to the place where the Meta Solutions, they go barging in. And as they barge in, you've got the Bee who is in this containment suit that looks like the light or the ray rather. And she's like, hey guys, you're just in time. Isn't this great? And you see, oh, the Fearsome Five is that group in the Teen Titans that they yep. fight with Mammoth and Simon and the
Hive kids.
Yeah, the smart yep. baby kid. So it's interesting because they're all sitting there, but they're all modern looking. And then it says coming up next, the Fearsome Six. So you see that this Meta Solutions is nothing but a front for the Fearsome Five, which is now going to maybe become the Fearsome Six. But again, if you're not reading Titans, it is a book as of now that's only coming out once a month. And at $2.99 once a month, this book is a deal. But not only is it a deal, it is just an amazing book.
Fantastic. I am going to now jump over to the Dark Horse universe and talk about a book that I reviewed the first issue of, I want to say, maybe a month ago, and that is Dead Inside.
Yes.
So Dead Inside is the story of Detective Linda Caruso, who is part of the jail crimes unit. So she gets called in when there is a homicide in jail, there's a crime that needs to be investigated, and she gets called to a murder in the first episode. And what we saw was that there was a very big inmate, big tough guy who was hacked and slashed to death, was basically gutted. And it seemed like his killer was this little scrawny guy who ended up hanging himself after he killed him. And it looked like it was a murder-suicide. Well, what they did at the end of the first episode was Linda, despite a lot of red tape from the administration at the jail, was able to do an autopsy of this particular guy who was the killer, this little scrawny guy. And what she found out was that in his stomach was a shell casing. And so when she fished that out, she realized that something is amiss here and there's more going on than just one inmate killing the other one and then sort of killing it himself. And it seemed like in the first issue that there was some sort of a cover-up going on. The warden was giving her the runaround. Her own boss was telling her to kind of wrap it up. This is an open and shut case, and she didn't want to go along with it. And so as we open up the second issue, she is back in the warden's office, Detective Caruso is, and she's saying, here's the thing. This is not an open and shut case. You know, one of your inmates may have murdered the other one, but we found the shell casing. And she's kind of walking through and saying, what I think happened is that someone else shot this inmate. And then your guy, the little scrawny guy, cut him open, fished out the bullet, and swallowed it to get rid of the evidence. Mm. And then, so it wasn't a shell case, it was the actual bullet to get rid of the evidence. And so the warden is being really dodgy around that, but now she's launched a full-fledged investigation and the sheriff's deputies are coming and they're going to start looking for evidence in the jail. And so she believes that she's onto something here. Meanwhile, the sheriff goes to the detective's boss and says, what do you got me dragged into this time? I thought this was an open and shut case. What's happening down at the jail? And her boss is saying, look, Caruso found that there was a bullet and there's not an explanation for it, and they're going to do this. And the sheriff is kind of saying, so you took this detective who couldn't handle being a detective on the regular force, and you put her on the jail crimes unit, and now she not only is not solving crimes, she's unsolving them. She took a case that was open and shut, and she's opening it back up again and causing me a lot of problems. But Caruso is on to something. And she's got these sheriff's deputies that are combing through the mess hall, combing through the cells, searching everywhere. But there's one guy who seems to be acting more fishy than the others, and it's actually someone that she knows. She knows one of the correctional officers, I think his name is Paris Taylor, who works at the jail. And he's a next-door neighbor to her. And so she's talking to him while her and one of the deputies are going through records and stuff like that. And this correctional officer says, I heard you were running tests on all of our sidearms. And she says, yeah, you know, the ballistics guy is going to be here in a little while. Can you take him up to the armory? And this CO is saying to her, but they said it was a hollow point bullet, so it would have kind of mushroomed when it went into the guy and you wouldn't be able to trace it, right? And she says, oh no, there's still some rifling from the barrel on it. We'll be able to find out who it is. And you see that this CO is getting a little nervous now. So it seems like he may have something to do with this, and he is a guy who knows the detective, and now he may be somehow involved in this. So what you get a lot throughout this issue is you get an explanation of the detective's backstory and sort of how she ended up on the jail crimes unit, because she used to be a beat cop at one point and she was a really good cop. She became a detective and she made some mistakes as a detective, and now she's on this jail crimes unit. But as she's talking to one of the deputies, he's saying like, I don't know why you're stuck with this job. You should be doing this other stuff. You're a great detective. But you're seeing a lot of the in-house politics of both the police department and the jail itself, and how it's all about who you know, and it's all about who plays the game, and it's all about that stuff. So not only is she trying to solve this mystery of who put up this inmate to making it look like he killed this other guy when clearly there was a third party involved, but why she's getting the runaround from all these administrators. So there's a lot of this sort of politics going on, and it feels like a well-written television show. Like each issue is an episode of this. And as this particular one goes along, she's now talking to some of the inmates and getting more pieces of the puzzle. And she gets a call from the wife of the correctional officer because he didn't come home from work that day. And as she's driving home, she's saying, I think everything's going to be fine. You know, it seems like this investigation, we're really on to something. And as she pulls into her driveway, she sees the CO who's half in the bag drinking and has his own gun to his head. So it seems like what she's been missing up to this point is that he's somehow very intimately involved in this situation. And now she's going to have to figure out sort of where she goes from there, because this is a guy that she knows. And they don't really tell you what her what it was that she did in the past that got her kicked off of the force or kicked off of that particular detective unit and got her put into jail's crimes unit. But it is, it's alluded to that she's not good at chasing the paper trail. She's not good at piecing clues together from that kind of stuff. She's more of a in-person interview, observe on what's going on the scene sort of person, which is why she has one of the deputies helping her. So I like that we're getting both the murder mystery story and a look into the politics of the situation, because you don't usually get both sides of that. It's a very sort of gritty looking book. It's a very graphic book. But if you like sort of hard boiled crime stories, or you like shows like Oz, or even it reminds me a lot of the, you know, the part in Watchmen where Rorschach goes to jail.
Yes.
And he's kind of dealing with all of those guys in jail. All of that stuff is sort of captured very well in here. So your creative team on this one, which I did not mention at the top of this, and my screen just went blank. Here we go. Is John Arcudi is the writer of this one. Tony Fazula is the artist. Colors by Andre May. Letters by Joe Sabino. Cover art by Dave Johnson. And your editor is Daniel Chabon. So Dead Inside, 2 issues in. I know issue 3, I believe, has at least come out so far. But 2 issues in, definitely a book worth picking up. And again, that one is from Dark Horse.
So the Justice League versus the Suicide Squad was a very good series, a lot of fun. And I remember back in the old days when you would have these big team ups or these big events, you were always going, all right, what's the book that's going to spin out of this one?
Right.
So we have Justice League America is the book that spins out of this one.
Not Justice League of America, Justice League America.
Justice League America. So big, you don't need the of in there.
Right.
And this is the rebirth issue. And what you think about all the rebirth issues that we've had in the past, this is the basic setup for what is going on.
So there was the zero issue, if you will.
Yes. And there was a little bit of a concern because I certainly wasn't going to get this one because of a lot of the things that have happened in the past with books like this. It's like, I'm reading Justice League. I don't want another one. It's going to start getting watered down. So where we start is Happy Harbor, Rhode Island, where the headquarters for the very original first Justice League was. You know the character Snapper Carr in Supergirl?
Yes.
The newspaper editor.
Yep.
Well, Snapper Carr was sort of the...
Who on the TV show is the jerk.
Yeah, he was kind of the tag... Yeah, yep. In the original comic, Snapper Carr was just this kid that kind of maintained and did the... and kept the Justice League headquarters clean and going until every... in between every episode or every issue. So you got Batman in there and he's with Killer Frost. And he's talking to her saying, you know... I haven't been in this place in a long time. It's really kind of an interesting place. And he flips open the light and he says, you know what? This is our future and your future. And you see that it is this basically abandoned headquarters. It's very primitive looking. It's in a cave, but it's got lights all over it, dust all over the computers, 2 or 3 different levels. And she's like, I thought you already had a cave, Batman. And he's like, well, I did, but you know, this is not going to be for me. This is going to be for us. He goes, I have an idea. And you're a part of this. You showed me a lot and you showed everybody a lot during the attack with Eclipso, because it ended up being Eclipso was the main bad guy in the Justice League Suicide Squad team up. And Caitlin had a huge change of heart. She became a hero. Batman sees a lot in her and he's like, you know what? I believe in you. I believe that you have redefined yourself and I think that you just need a platform to do this.
Which is in keeping with where they're taking her with the TV show.
Yes.
Yeah.
A character that is good by heart, good nature, has a bad side. And that's really, like you said, it's really what they've done here.
Which when you think about it, a lot of the female villains in the DC universe have that sort of duality to them. You know, you've got your Harley Quinn, you've got Poison Ivy, you've got Catwoman.
Yes.
Killer Frost fits within that mold for sure.
So he tells her, we're going to build a team and we are going to be the team that doesn't have any gods on it. And Batman says, when you're not fighting and dealing with gods, you don't need a god on the team. And I'm like, okay, that kind of makes a little sense.
It's like Defenders, like street level sort of.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's the depowered team, which when you have a team like the Justice League, you have a team like the Avengers, and you think of the old classic Avengers – what threat could possibly cause this team any problems? Because they're just so vast and so big.
And it's kind of like the whole like Avengers versus like Spider-Woman yeah. sort of thing, where like she wants to deal with the day-to-day, what's happening on the street, what's happening to the everyman, and the you know, A-team, if you will, should be dealing with the cosmic level events.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what I really like about this is that after Batman talks to her, she goes to Seattle and she gets into a fight with a Black Canary. And they're fighting, and she's like, you know, I can't believe this, Killer Frost. You know, why would you even come in here? And she goes, you know what? You don't even know what you're talking about. And she's like, okay, what are you saying? What is going on? Why are you here? Why are we even fighting? And she puts some cold on her. She screams and gets the cold out and says, you know, I'm not fighting back as much as I could because I respect you, and he wants you on his team. And she's like, who's he? And she looks up, and there's Batman in the shadows. So Batman comes down and talks to her and says, you know, oh, so you're aligning yourself with somebody named Killer? And she goes, look, I trust her. That's all you need to know. I'm starting something different, a team of mortals. Frost is my first member. I see what you've done here. I see what you do here. I really think that you would be a valuable commodity to this team. So she goes, all right, you know what? I'm in. Now, the next one is you're in Mammoth City, New Jersey, and you've got like this biker bar that looks like all these space vehicles, and they're all up parked on a roof of a building, so you don't even see them. And then something comes crashing through the glass, and there's a big bar fight going on, and it is Lobo. So Lobo's fighting somebody, and as he's laying there on
the ground. And this is the Lobo that we know from before. This is not the redesigned New 52 yes. Lobo.
Yeah, because that never happened. We just...
You blocked that out from your consciousness?
I blocked that out because that was horrible. So as you see, Lobo is fighting somebody, and you see, like, as he's looking up, you just see this long fishnet leg. So you know it's Black Canary that's taking him down. So she's fighting with him. And what I love is that every new member is the member going out to recruit the next member.
Oh,
so
I like that.
You're seeing how they come in, and then you're seeing their sales pitch to the next person. So as Black Canary is there, she's like, look, you know, Batman wants to start this team, and I really think that we ought to do it. He's got a special plan for you. And she goes, you know what? Tell him to ask me myself. And she goes, well, he sent me. I really think that you ought to take him up on this offer because I think that this is a pretty good deal. And he's like, you know what? I think fishnets, I think you and me are a lot more alike than you want to think, and let's do this. So next we go to Ivy University, which is somewhere in New England, and you've got this young kid who is running around, and all of a sudden he turns into the Atom and sneaks through his phone because he has been being told that if – and I forgot the guy's name. It's Cho is his last name. It might be Thomas Cho is the new Atom. He's been the Atom for a while because Ray Palmer is missing. And the people there are saying, look, he's your friend. You need to find him. Now, if you don't find Professor Palmer, you're not going to have a job at this university anymore. So he goes – Adam's out. He goes through the World Wide Web, ends up through his computer and into his office, and standing there is Lobo and Batman. And she goes, Batman says, this is Ray Palmer's office or lab. Where is he? And who are you? And he goes, Ryan. It's Ryan Cho. And he goes, I'm Ryan Cho. I was a friend of Professor Palmer's, and he let me work as the Atom while he went missing. So she goes, all right. He's like, all right, well, I don't really think that we want you. I think Batman is the one, or I think we wanted Palmer. We're putting together a team. And then it's Lobo that convinces Batman to take a chance on him. So now you have the Atom who's in, and the Atom goes to City of Vanity, Oregon, where the Ray is doing some crazy stuff. He's saving the day. The Atom shows up and talks to the Ray. Now, I know very little about the Ray to begin with. So Ray comes on board the team. And then finally, you've got Vixen that shows up, and Black Canary is the one to kind of recruit her. And Batman is there with her as well. So you have Vixen come in, and Vixen is saying, look, you know, I'm a model, and that's kind of my life, and that's what I do. So, you know, I don't know if I really want to do this superhero thing anymore. And then Batman tells her, you know, without you, I really don't have a team. And tells her how he really feels, really enjoys what she sees. And then he zaps her out. They go out, and they end up in the Happy Harbor for their first meeting. And he talks about the same thing, saying, you know, sometimes we need to take care of things on a street level. we, you know, the Justice League can save the world. We need to save the people. And then you see that that is the team where it's all put together. And then you have the last page of preview of who they're going to be fighting and what's going on. Very good book. Very excited about that one. As we talk about the $3.99, and I think that was a big thing. If they are and when they all go to $3.99, I really want to be entrenched in this book enough to like it. I didn't even give you the creative teams. Writing it is Steve Orlando, and Ivan Reese does the pencils. Now, all you need to know about Ivan and Joe Prado and Declare Albert are the anchors. All you need to know about Ivan is that he did an amazing job on Green Lantern during the Blackest Night run, and he is one of the best artists that's out there. So a book that I was very excited about and glad I got it.
Fantastic.
Yes.
I will have to check that one out. I have not read the – I started reading a few issues of Justice League of America.
Yes.
And I started reading the first couple issues of Trinity, but I feel like Trinity was late. It wasn't coming out as regularly.
Yeah.
And I kind of fell off of it. So I'm not reading any like big team books over there. Most of my books that I read from DC right now are – I think Batgirl and the Birds of Prey might be the only team book I'm reading. But I'm not reading any other ones. So I have a spot for that.
Very good.
On my
I think you'll like it.
On my virtual shelf, if you will, Matthew. Now it is time for a boob tube and big screen bonanza. And we're going to start this week by talking about Legion.
Yes.
Now, if you've seen the first episode of Legion on FX, then you are either saying this is one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen, or what in the world is this thing supposed to be, or a combination of the both of them. I'm going to read you the premise to this series, Matthew, because I think it will help frame our discussion of the first issue. Because I don't know about you, but I had not read any of the comics that have anything to do with any of these characters.
Me neither.
At all. I knew nothing about – all I know is it is somehow related to the X-Men universe. Is that what your preface is? Okay. So here's what it says. Here's the Wikipedia overview of Legion. It says, David Haller is a troubled young man who was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a child. He has been in and out of psychiatric hospitals for years and now in his early 30s finds himself institutionalized again. His daily routine, including therapy, taking medications, and silently listening to a talkative friend, Lenny, is upended when troubled new patient Sid arrives, and they are inexplicably drawn to each other. After a startling encounter between the two, David confronts the possibility that the voices he hears and visions he sees may be real. He escapes from the hospital and seeks refuge with sister Amy, who wants to protect the picture-perfect suburban life she has established for herself. Sid eventually gets David involved with therapist Melanie Bird and her team of specialists who open his eyes to a new world of possibilities. So that is essentially the summary of the first episode of Legion. Everything that's described in that synopsis is pretty much what happens in the first episode. So I guess the question is, as you watched that first episode, Matthew, how do you think they executed on what I just said to you?
I think they did a pretty good job. However, if you think about the way it was, I mean, you basically have seen, if you're watching it, I think it was 90 minutes.
I think it was. I didn't even notice how long it was because I was watching it on demand.
Yeah.
And it felt longer than a regular TV episode.
So you have the first 45 minutes to an hour of the schizophrenia and the insanity of what he sees, because you're being introduced to all these things and then it completely changes to something different. Then it goes somewhere else. And then you're seeing this and then you're seeing that. Then he meets a girl and everything seems to be kind of cool and calm. And then all of a sudden she's gone and she may not have ever even existed, or she died.
Right.
And all this crazy stuff is going on. And for a while, as I was watching it, I just was like, every time they would skip to something, I got out of it a little less. I kept pulling back a little bit more. And to the point where maybe 15, 20 minutes before the end, I was almost like, just end. Now, the cast is...
Now, of course, when it gets closer to the end, the action really picks up and things sort of take a big turn.
Yep. And you understand and know, like I told my wife, I said, I don't know anything about this character.
Uh-huh.
But I said, he's hearing voices in his head and he's seeing visions. And if you think about the world of mutants, that this is not necessarily a schizophrenic person like we might know in society now.
Yeah, and on the psychological part of the show, I mean, there's a lot of sort of cliches about residential facilities,
yes,
and about diagnoses, but you know, between schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder, and stuff like that. Like there, some of that stuff, I think they play a little fast and loose
one
with.
I just watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest maybe a couple weeks ago.
Yep,
that intro part.
Very much.
Very, yeah. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
So I think one of the reasons they play a little fast and loose with it is A, because it's a television show,
yep,
and B, because they are specifically trying to invoke things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's,
yes,
Nest, right? So what I felt like when I watched the show, and I will agree with you, it was confusing.
Yeah.
You know, even I thought that I feel like I had the through line through the episode, but yeah, there were definitely times where you're like, is this happening before or after? Is this real or not,
yep,
real? Which, again, I think a lot of it is by design.
Mm-hmm.
What immediately struck me about this show the second that I started watching it was the visual design.
Yeah.
This feels like it was directed by Stanley Kubrick.
Because it has a Clockwork Orange feel to it.
Not
as
only
far
Clockwork
as, like,
Orange,
furniture,
but The Shining. Like,
yes.
There are many nods and homages to horror movies, to certain directorial styles,
yes,
to cinematography. So that to me was joyful. Like,
yeah,
as I watched this episode, I was like, this is eye candy. Everything that's happening here, it's super Twin Peaksy.
Yeah.
It's very David Lynchian. Like, it feels like, to me, it felt like that David Lynch and Stanley Kubrick did an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And that was what,
yeah,
I was watching. And so just on that level alone, I was like, this is amazing. I love this. I love everything about it. You know, the guy who every time they do a shot of the main sitting area in this institution that they're in, you see the guy who is basically camouflaging himself in a picture of the forest against,
yeah,
the back wall. Never do you hear words from him. Never, not even really do they focus on him. They just sort of pan the camera across him as they're going. It's those little things,
yeah,
that I absolutely adored. Like, that reminds me of like the Log Lady from Twin Peaks and stuff like that.
Log Lady.
So to me, like, that kind of stuff was just, there was a lot of treats there.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And, I thought that the guy who, and I don't know the actor who's playing, David Haller in this one. Maybe I can pull up the cast here. Because Aubrey Plaza is the one that plays Lenny.
And she's awesome.
And she's great.
This role was designed for her.
Absolutely.
If you know her quirkiness, if you've watched her on Parks and Rec.
See, and the thing is I haven't been a huge Parks and Rec person. Dan Stevens, I believe, is the guy. Jean Smart is the one that plays Melanie Bird in this.
Yep.
And she's fantastic as well. So, I mean, overall, I love the casting. The look of it is just absolutely amazing, and clearly it's designed to keep you guessing because they're trying to put you in his head.
Yes.
And this guy's everyday existence is, I think I know, but I don't know for sure what's real.
Yeah.
And so as time goes on, and then even the humans that are interacting with him in this show are purposefully not telling him what's real. So in the part where he is – after the incident happens at the hospital,
yep,
when, you know, people die and some – like a very supernatural sort of event happens at this hospital, he's being interviewed by these people who have taken him into custody after, and the answers that they're not giving him are making him question whether or not that even happened.
Yeah.
And so not only does he have what's going on in his own head making him question what reality is, he has the people who are dealing with him making him question it even further. And that to me is kind of horrifying because that, you know, being someone who is really interested in psychology, that was my minor in school and working in human services and stuff like that. Like that, as someone who is entrusted with the care of another human being, there is a lot of power and responsibility in,
yeah,
that. And what you see in this episode a lot is that the people that are supposed to be helping this guy are making things worse for him. They are making him question whether or not even normal things that he's seeing are actually happening. And that just furthers what's going on inside of his head. And if you just put yourself in his shoes for a second and think about, like, imagine if you had trouble to begin with distinguishing reality from fiction.
Yeah.
And then the people that were closest to you were purposefully feeding into that
and
making you think that you were even more out of touch with what was happening. So that was fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. So I really liked the first episode of that. I feel like it's going to get a little more concrete in the coming episodes, because by the end of this first episode, you think that you see what's actually happening here. That in fact, most of what has happened to this guy is in fact real.
Yeah.
And there are people now who are going to help him be able to distinguish what's real and what's not real, and also put what his true abilities are to use. So the first thing I thought after watching the first episode of Legion was, I want to watch this again right now. And just from a visual standpoint, I could turn off the volume and watch what's happened. There's dance numbers in this.
Yeah.
There are, the use of music is wonderful. The whole, everything, the design of it is just like awesome.
All the furniture was off. If you think, when you watch it and you're looking at the furniture, and that's a huge Stanley Kubrick thing.
That's what I'm saying.
Where, like, you looked at like the desks, like when they were in the desks, and instead of being a normal desk with flat edges all the way around, there were little cuts in. So you could kind of fit yourself in there and become closer to the people you're talking to, which, completely uncomfortable.
Right. Now, some of those particular devices are made in ways to be restraining.
Yeah.
Made in ways to for particular, like, sensory purposes and stuff like that. But there was a lot of stuff in the episode that was like askew or slightly out of place or things to just make you constantly feel like you're unsettled.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me was just awesome, the way that they handle that. So I'm super, like, I came out of that episode like, this is better than almost all the X-Men stuff that I've watched.
Yeah.
You know, to this point. So the second episode, I think, just came out last night. I cannot wait to go back and watch that. I am super excited about that show, and I knew nothing about it and would not have watched it unless I saw a few people that I trust the opinion of, like, raving about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I need to watch that now.
I'm going to give it another shot, or I'll give the second episode a try. And interesting things, like when you think about like a mental institution and where I was going with The One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And growing up, my mother got her nursing license at Belchertown, which was a mental hospital back in the 70s. So I spent a lot of time there because they used to encourage the staff to bring their kids. So I used to go there all the time, was exposed to things I probably shouldn't have been at a very young age, of just people behaving completely out of control. And the thing that I took out of that, and another thing that made me off and uncomfortable, was in this asylum type atmosphere, it was so bright and colorful. And that's not what your brain tells you it's going to be. If you're in an institution, it's supposed to be gray and dark and cold. Here it was bright and sunny, and everybody was a little weird, but it was like those were those off-putting things that kind of kept you off balance the entire time you were watching it. And obviously by design.
Yeah, I cannot wait to watch more of that show. So that was Legion. We are one episode behind on Riverdale, so we've seen the first three episodes. Episode 4 aired last night.
Yep.
The last episode that we saw was the one with Ethel, who was played by the same actress that played Barb in Stranger Things.
Yes.
And so she, brilliant move by them in casting her in that show. She was a fan favorite of Stranger Things. Now she shows up in Riverdale. It's like, same demographic.
You
know what I mean? Like, same audience that would watch Stranger Things is the audience that you're trying to get to watch Riverdale. Having her show up, great connection. And it was about basically members of the boys' football team that had a club where they were keeping score of all the girls that they had stated or claimed that they had done sexual things with.
Yep.
And so Betty and Veronica sort of uncover this and expose what's going on. And in the process, you see that Jason Blossom, who was one of the people that was killed, was a part of this, of what was happening, which lends further motive to maybe someone who killed him.
Yes.
You also have Dilbert, who we find out is doomsday prepper.
Yes.
And he was out shooting that day in the woods where they heard the gunshot. We also have heard over the past couple episodes that the time frames of that one day when a gunshot was heard on the 4th is not the actual day that Jason was shot.
Yep.
So that didn't happen at the same time. And of course, you have Archie, who's struggling with the fact that he was out there on the 4th with Miss Grundy. She doesn't want him to say anything because that is going to cast a spotlight on her. And it paints her in a very bad light because she's being very selfish about that. He ends up going and telling anyways, but basically keeping her out of it and saying that he was there that day. But what the thing that I like the most, the two things that I like the most about what we're seeing so far is, one, the building relationship between Betty and Veronica.
Yep.
I think that their where in the first episode, it could have gone the way of them just being straight rivals. They have really experienced some things between the two of them over these first three episodes that are building that relationship. And I really like that.
Yep.
And this time it is Betty that sort of takes it to another level.
She goes over the top.
Because she's clearly still dealing with what happened to her sister. So I love it. I love that what you expect from Betty and Veronica is almost flip-flopped.
Yes.
What we're seeing through the first three episodes is that Veronica may be more grounded. And Betty, despite what you think, you know, in terms of her being sort of the perfect girl with the perfect grades, with the, that's not what's happening at all.
No, there is a dark side to her.
Yes. And then, but the other favorite thing is we now are getting much more of Jughead. And we're getting, and it was, it's Cole, not Dylan.
It's Cole.
I think
Sprouse.
In the last one, you
did,
said
did
it was Dylan. It's Cole that is the one who is, Jughead in this one, but his character now is sort of the investigative reporter for the Blue and Gold, which is the school newspaper, which I really like that twist.
Yep.
I like that him and Betty are working together. I love that he is sort of not only the narrative voice of the show, but now the investigative, you know, sort of character on the show. I really like where they've put Jughead, you know, in terms of that. And you get to see him sort of unraveling the mystery as things go along here. So I just, every episode, I like it more.
Yeah. And a couple of the twists in here, and one of the ones, so we meet Chuck Jones, or not Chuck Jones, Chuck, I forgot his last
from the
name.
Football team.
From the football team.
Yep.
Whose father, Chuck Cowles. Chuck Clayton.
His father is the coach.
And that's right out of the comics. But again, what I did not like is that Chucky in the comics is an artist. He's an athlete. Great kid. This kid's a friggin' loser. And you want to beat the heck out of him.
Right. He's sort of the head of this ring of football players that have
been shaming
keeping
young girls and doing all this stuff. Now, the thing that I was – when I'm watching it, I'm like, who is this kid? And do you remember Unfabulous with Emma Roberts? That might be way before your kids' time.
But that was a show
that we used to love, and he was the cute, geeky, always putting his foot in his mouth kid on the show. Unfabulous is one of the best shows that you'd ever see.
Huh.
As far as kids' show, it was a great show. But then we get at the end of the episode. I don't remember if it was part of the episode or it was in the previews of Miss Grundy may not be what we think she is.
It was the previews for the next episode where you see that she is, because Miss Grundy in the comics is an old woman.
And you see that Miss Grundy in the show should be an
old
woman.
So I like that they're even playing with that of like, that's not like the comics. And they're like, oh, that's for a reason.
Yes.
So that is what was revealed in last night's episode, which we haven't watched yet. So,
yeah, so you may have her saying, you know, like you're thinking, oh, Archie, don't tell anybody we were there because we shouldn't be there because you're a student, I'm a teacher, and that's wrong. I may be somebody else.
My daughter, who is an eighth grader, absolutely loves Riverdale.
Yes.
And that's a show that we both watch and then talk about together.
Yep.
Because she's going into high school next year. That kind of stuff happens in eighth grade as well.
Yep.
And so it's, on the one hand, it's some pretty heavy stuff that they're tackling. On the other hand, there are some real messages in the show that I am glad to see them tackling so far. So Riverdale's great, man.
Yeah.
I'm super, which is why I'm even more excited about the news we read about Archie in the beginning of this episode. So that was that. The Flash was not new this week. The last episode that we saw featured the character of Ash, who was basically has a corrosive touch that can decay whatever he touches, and Iris was touched. And what's been going on with Iris with lately is that because she may die in a couple months, that has put her in a situation where she is struggling to handle that, but also believes that there is an air of invincibility to her because she knows when she's going to die.
Yep.
So she has no problem confronting this guy today because in her mind, I'm not supposed to die for a couple more months. So you're not the one that's going to kill me. Sure enough, she almost gets killed by this guy.
Yeah.
And so they're playing with this whole idea of the future's not set in stone. They've heard very clearly what is supposed to happen. They're trying to change that from happening to Iris because Savitar is supposed to kill her. But everybody's sort of struggling with, is time set or is time fluid?
Yes.
And so that has been really sort of interesting to see. And that was a good episode because we're also seeing Wally, who is becoming kind of a rival to Barry in that he wants to prove himself.
Yes.
He constantly wants to show that he's faster than Barry, that he's picking up on his powers more quickly, that he has more potential. And Barry has come to him and said, it's actually you that's going to need to save Iris. That's how we can change the future. You can be the one to save her because you're going to be faster than me. And so we have that sort of storyline going on as well. And that's been really cool. We have, is it Nigel? Is that his name?
Yes, the Brit. Yes.
The kid from Harry Potter.
Yep.
Who was, what was his name in Harry Potter?
I don't remember.
I can't remember either.
I didn't even know he was in Harry Potter.
Yeah, he was like the bad guy. One of the mean kids from Harry Potter.
Holy crap, that's him?
Draco Malfoy. That was who he
Holy
was in Harry
cow,
Potter.
Holy
yes.
cow, that is him.
So he's in this show now. He's now become a part of the team. You know, he's kind of the jerk with a heart of gold,
yep.
you know, sort of situation going on. I like where the team is at right now. I really love, and I know some people don't, this incarnation of Harrison Wells.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
I love it.
I know
I
you
love
do. I'm not
it.
A
and,
fan.
And we did talk about it here. It's because of the fact that this HR version of Wells is much closer to, like, Tom Cavanaugh's actual personality,
yep.
who plays him. And so I like that. And he seems to be having a lot of fun with that. So I feel like that show's in a really good place right now.
Yeah. So another show that premiered a couple weeks ago, and we haven't talked about it. I think the third episode aired last night, and I watched it, is Powerless. Now, Powerless is a half-hour comedy taking place in the DC universe, and it's kind of DC's first foray into something other than the hour-long dramas.
Yep.
And so far, I'm really liking it. Now, it is not laugh-out-loud funny. It is a cute show. And what it is it's a division of Wayne Industries in a city that is just constantly having superhero stuff. Like, you know, Vanessa Hudgens, who was from
High School Musical.
Yeah. I didn't even recognize her at first, is this young girl that comes in and she's working. She's head of the R&D department at this industry. And they're chief rival is LexCorp. Everything they're doing, they've got to keep battling them for market share. Oh, they got the best jobs. And there's a great thing, a scene where she's in there going, hey, you know what? We need to do a little bit better than we have a purple Joker antidote pen right here. Sold gangbusters. Next year, we released one that is a little darker purple. Why are we not trying to fix the ingredients? And they're like, oh, you don't understand. That's not purple. That's topaz and all this stuff. So this episode had.
And Alan Tudyk is in the show.
Alan
isn't
Tudyk
he?
Is, yeah. Is a Wayne. He is like the third cousin of Bruce Wayne.
Uh-huh.
His whole goal is to get to Gotham to work for Wayne Corp or Wayne Tech there.
Okay.
And, you've got the kid who was in, Community. I can't think of his name. Drawn a blank, but he is perfect for the role. Then there's another cast, and you have one of the guys who is part Atlantean, but you wouldn't see it. And the whole half the episode's jokes were all about racial profiling kind of thing, like because he's a large black guy, and they're like, "You're an Atlantean? You don't look like an." I thought you said you were from Atlanta. Oh, what are you saying?
Yeah,
you know, and all this stuff. So everything anybody said was kind of this mix up of, you know, I thought you were from here. I thought you were from this. And they have the Atlantean handshake because they bring in some Atlanteans to try to help them with something.
Now, are they going to have cameos from actual like CW shows and stuff like that?
I don't know what the plan is, but what they do is like.
Because that would be cool, right?
Yeah. Like they're all late to work and they don't have to explain why they're late to work because some villain destroyed the train tracks.
Do they mention villains by name in the show a lot?
The villains you see there are made up. Like the villains, it's like, you know, like, it's the Crimson Fox.
Okay, yeah.
Something you don't know. But when they were doing their fantasy draft in the second episode, they were doing superhero fantasy draft. And he was like, well, I picked Superman last year. Yeah, and you got screwed on that one because Superman went out to space.
That
was
my main concern is like, I just want them to acknowledge, even though it's on a different network, I want them to acknowledge the other characters that are out there. I want it to feel like part of the DC universe.
Yes. Like they're arguing in the break room about you laughed at my theory that Bruce Wayne is really the Flash.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, how can he be the Flash? He's never in this. You never see them together. And all this stuff. He's like, come on, he's a fast guy. And he's Bruce Wayne is rich. Doesn't that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Where they're completely off on these things. But the superhero draft was the one where they were really bringing in some names in there. It's like, yeah, you can't go with Superman. He's off planet and you lose your stats.
I'm going to have to watch that on demand because I haven't watched any of them yet.
And it's cute. I mean, again, you're not laughing out loud, but Corbin Burnson showed up as Alan Tiddick's father, who was very disappointed that they lost the Acme Chemical account.
Because it's Warner Brothers, dude. Yes. Like they have all that they could play with too.
And he came in and said, you know, when I started this company, I opened up the phone book and I went to the first company I saw. Who do you think that was? And Alan Tudyk's like naming all these things. He goes, no, I opened the phone book alphabetically. Oh, Acme Chemical. Yes, that was the first company I got. And there's some great moments. And again, Vanessa Hudgens she has a singing scene at the end, which was really cute.
I'm going to have to check it out. The last thing I just wanted to mention, I know you have not been keeping up with Arrow. This week's episode was about gun control, and they kind of tackled some heavy stuff in it. You get to see the origin of Wild Dog.
Wild Dog.
And in, I don't know what his origin is in the comics, but in this one, he's a very pro-gun. Obviously, he wields two guns as a hero. Mr. Terrific, very much in favor of like gun control and stuff like that. And Ollie's the mayor now. So he's the mayor of Star City. And so he has to deal with the fact that there was a shooting incident.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what are they going to do about gun control? And some people want to registry and some people don't. And it was pretty heavy stuff for Arrow to be tackling. And I thought they did a good job with it because at the end, they're just trying to start a conversation. They don't have all the answers, but they weren't afraid to have the conversation. And I thought that was pretty cool. And you have members of the team who are on both sides of that fight and in very different roles. And so I thought they took a pretty balanced approach to that. But it was interesting to see like how Wild Dog became who he was, what he was inspired by. He actually decided to become a vigilante the night that he saw Damian Dark get killed by Arrow on the show. And so it sort of delves into that. You had Thea come back into the picture for this episode. You have more focus on Ollie being the mayor and the things that he has to deal with outside of the Green Arrow costume. And I thought that was pretty cool. And so I like where they're going with this because I have fond memories of when Mike Norton was doing Green Arrow and they were tackling Ollie being the mayor.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff is that was when I was reading Green Arrow until I was reading it again now. And so that show is doing really well. So yeah. So lots of good stuff, man. Lots of good stuff to catch up on. I'm still behind on Supergirl because my son's basketball practice is every Monday night and goes right into Supergirl. So I got to catch up on that. And I'm behind on Legends of Tomorrow as well. And I want to catch up on that, but I also want to check out Powerless. So, but let us know what you have been watching. Let us know what you have been liking or not liking, because that is going to wrap up our BoobTube and Big Screen Bonanza. And it's also going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.